Chicago, where I worked for WBEZ as a producer and then as a reporter, and they did a lot of business and mostly housing market stories. I did a lot of coverage of kind of the crash of the housing market and what it meant for average homeowners and what the foreclosure crisis meant for certain blocks of Chicago, which has been really devastated by it. So along the way of doing a lot of those stories kind of opened me up to more investigative work on real estate stories. And so I'm going to, in this presentation, walk you through a couple of real estate investigative stories that I did and how I did them, what I think worked, what I think didn't work. When you go back and listen to your stories, I don't know if everybody has this experience, but you know, you'll have this story that you're really proud of, and you go back and listen to it, and you're like, oh my God, that didn't work. So that happened to me after I was asked to do this presentation, and so I will disclose all of that. The first story that I want to walk you through is, it has to do with shoddy construction. So I'm going to give you 10 tips on doing an investigative story. And my first tip is do a story about something that people really care about, something that matters to people. Because especially with investigative work, if you're going to invest a lot of time in it, you want it to be something that people really care about. So in doing these stories in Chicago about the real estate crisis, just from talking to people, people started saying, my new condo is really crappily made. You know, it was built 2 years ago. Things are falling apart. And at first I just kind of thought, oh, these are just cranky, people, complainers, spent a lot of money and now the value's gone down. They're just unhappy. So I kind of blew it off. But I heard so many people saying this that I started thinking, well, maybe there's something more here. Maybe there's something more going on. So I started calling up building inspectors, the private building inspectors that people hire when they're going to buy a house, and asking them about it. And I said, yeah, there's a lot of problems out here. This stuff that was built during the housing crisis, I mean, before the housing crisis, during the boom, was really just kind of slapped together. And there's a lot of problems. And there's a lot of people kind of stuck with these poorly made buildings. And so I said, okay, how do I boil that down? What's the biggest problem out there? And then a couple of them said, the biggest problem is this concrete block that has been used. In Chicago, a lot of the traditional houses were kind of this old gray stone, really sturdy kind of brick and gray stone. And during the housing boom, these developers started kind of cutting corners to make a better, bigger profit. And they essentially use cinder block. And the problem in Chicago is that the rain kind of pounds, similar to the coast of Alaska almost. The rain can really just pound against these buildings. And so people were having leaky, this water leaking in through their walls. And that it had been improperly built. And so I was like, well, that is a pretty dramatic thing. And they said that a lot of people were experiencing this. So here I'm going to play you the opening part of the story that I did.
Juanita Owens is giving a tour of the condo at 43rd and South Vincennes where she thought she'd retire in style.
Oh, wait, let me just stop.
It hasn't turned out that way.
Let me just stop.
Come on.
Okay, you know how I said that there's problems that I noticed? So the problem with this one is my voicing. So just putting that out there, it's not well tracked. It's kind of low energy.
What are all these towels here?
That's to get the water. I'm not home. The water comes in, as you can see. Then I don't want the floors to buckle. That's more damage.
A stream of water flows through Owen's ceiling with every big storm, leaving chunks of paint peeling off. Black mold creeps up her window frames. Owens and her neighbors moved into their new three-unit condo building in 2004. Pretty soon, it started leaking. They hired private inspectors who found lots of problems with the exterior walls made of concrete block. Owens' neighbor, Michelle Elias, says the developer kept promising to seal the concrete to stop the leaking.
He would say, well, oh, you know, the building needs to be sealed. I'll send my masonry out. And that's the last reply that I actually got from him before he disappeared.
Michelle Elias had never heard of split-face concrete block. Private home inspector Steve Heyer is all too familiar with it.
And here we even have a bigger crack.
I asked Heyer to come look at Elias's concrete block walls. He traces a crack that zigzags through the mortar. Heyer says he sees buildings like this several times a week.
See these little waterfalls? And here's literally a hole in a mortar joint that was never tooled properly. Here we have another crack.
Split-face concrete block has a rough surface reminiscent of traditional Chicago graystone. Thousands of these buildings popped up all over Chicago in the past 15 years. Picture all those shiny condos in places like Bucktown and Lakeview. On the front is brick, but the sides are gray concrete blocks. Concrete block is a lot cheaper than regular brick, less than half the cost. The problem is, it leaks if it's not installed with proper water repellents and drainage features. Heyer says the city could catch faulty masonry if it took inspections seriously.
When I get involved in lawsuits as an expert witness, I will look at the blueprints. And the architect drew it up properly. The city has stamped off on the prints as being fine, but the person that did the work didn't do it. Who's watching something that I think is just totally critical for people like Michelle?
So that is, I kind of covered this already, but my second tip is just start reading and start talking to people. And as I was talking to all these inspectors, and they were telling me what the problems were, they kept saying, you know, why did the city not catch this? The city has building inspectors. The city sends these people out, the inspectors, just to give something called a certificate of occupancy once a new building has gone up. They're supposed to check, you know, that everything's been done properly, that the construction is good. So why didn't the city catch this? And so that was really interesting. I thought, okay, so let's make this about, you know, this lack of city oversight. And so then my third tip is find good characters and good scenes. Michelle Elias, you heard, she's really energetic. She's really, you know, cares a lot about this. She had like a big folder this big of all the documents from her building and, you know, all her efforts to contact the city and to, you know, see what was going on. And so the way I found her, I was trying to remember how I found her, but I think that the way I found her was I talked to a bunch of real estate attorneys as well, in addition to the inspectors. And every time I talked to the attorneys, I'd say, okay, do you have anybody who's gone through this? Would they be willing to talk to me? So those attorneys, the inspectors, they often can put you in touch with people who would be good examples. So that's how I found her, and Juanita was in the building as well. And obviously for a story like this, you want to make people care about it, you have to have good characters. So the next step is, okay, figure out what documents you need and where they are, and also keep your ears open. So, okay, you know, we face this as reporters all the time. There's just this, like, sea of information out there. Every time we start a story, we don't understand anything about it. We don't know, you know, what's going on. You don't understand, you know, fishing regulations or, you know, something that you have to kind of start from the ground up. So, luckily, in Chicago, the flack at the buildings department was relatively helpful. And he got me things like the building permits for her building so I could see, okay, who built it, you know, and try to contact that guy, see, okay, what inspections were done. So he was able to get me those. Now, in passing, my editor, this is kind of an unusual example of the editor playing a role in the reporting. She really wanted to understand it, too. And so she called him, and they were chatting. And he said, oh, you know, there's this ordinance about concrete block, you know, from a few years ago. She's like, really? There's an ordinance about concrete block? So, you know, her ears were open. Okay, there's an ordinance about concrete block. So we pulled up the ordinance, and it says that it's all supposed to be sealed properly. You know how the inspector said, this isn't sealed, you know, this is all going to leak in. Okay, so they're supposed to seal it. So then from that, knowing that there was this ordinance, in talking with my editor, we were like, okay, how did it come about? Who sponsored it? What happened? So we kind of through reporting, found out that initially this one alderman in Chicago, they're called aldermen on the city council, had wanted to completely ban concrete block. She was hearing so many problems of it in her ward that she, you know, didn't want it used at all. Then it turned out, under pressure from developers, that she had to kind of scale that back. And so she proposed this ordinance that would require sealant applied. And so that was like, okay, that's an interesting story in and of itself, you know, that she actually wanted to get rid of it. They didn't get rid of it. Now all these people have this problem, you know. So from there, I would say my next number five tip is talking to people off the record is also very useful. Even if people say, you know, I'm not going to talk to you, try to say, okay, what if we don't use your name? What if I just talk to you off the record? Because that information you can use for your reporting and going to the people who will talk to you on the record. So from talking to people off the record, I found out, I found out from one of the building inspectors that that the city had one masonry inspector for the whole city of Chicago. This one guy was tasked with examining all the brickwork of all these buildings that were going up. I mean, thousands of these buildings. He was fired. I mean, actually, he wasn't. His position was eliminated. He was moved to a different department. So then they had no masonry inspector. And I went back and I found in the budget where his job had been eliminated. So that's interesting, too. All of a sudden, the city doesn't even have a masonry inspector, and it has this huge problem with these leaky concrete walls. And so I wanted to talk to this guy. And it was hard to figure out, okay, who was he in the first place? I mean, I couldn't get it from the buildings department, the FLAC. So I wound up calling the Union of Masons, and they said, oh, yeah, that guy, his name is, I forget what it was. And I said, okay, do you have a cell phone for him? And he did, and he gave it to me. So I called him, and he didn't want to go on the record, obviously, but he talked to me. He talked to me about his job and what he did and how he would check whether there had been sealant applied. And essentially, what I had heard from the private inspectors was that you can't just look at it and see that it's been sealed. You have to actually do this test where you take a sample of it and see whether this sealant has been applied. And he said, no, I didn't do that. I would, you know, look and I would check to see if they had, like, the buckets of sealant there, you know, or ask them. And it was like, okay, so it seems like there wasn't a whole lot of oversight of, you know, that this was being applied, that this was really being done when there was this huge building boom. So, you know, armed with that knowledge, I was on to my sixth tip, which is prepare really well before you do your key interviews. You know, before you're going to go to the person who you're going to kind of hold to the fire, you know, you want to really know everything in and out and be as knowledgeable as you can. And also, I think it's really important that you don't ambush them. You don't set them up for total, you know, shock. You want them to be prepared, too. You want them to have the answers, and you just want to be fair. So, you know, I have to tell the FLAC, okay, I'm working on this story. I want to ask you why, you know, how the city oversees whether this ordinance has been enforced, whether people are applying the sealant that they're supposed to, blah, blah, blah. And so I did go to interview him, and I'm going to play a little bit of that part of the story. It starts out with Alderman Vidaly, who is the one who had sponsored the ordinance.
As they're building, the intention really was to make sure that someone from the building department went out there to make sure that they were installing it properly.
But the ordinance may not be delivering what Daly intended. The city doesn't even have a masonry inspector. That job was eliminated at the beginning of this year. Now Chicago's 14 new construction inspectors are supposed to inspect masonry. Buildings department spokesman Bill McCaffrey says they're carpenters by trade. But he says they're qualified to make sure the masonry follows the building plan. He says they look to see whether flashing and weep holes have been put in and can ask for invoices to prove the block contains water repellent. But as for actually checking that the concrete block is sealed, McCaffrey says there are two tests they could do. One is a water penetration test.
We do not do that test.
And what's the other test?
The chipping off a piece of block and sending it off to a lab to be analyzed.
And do you guys do that?
No. That test is very expensive.
So that portion of this ordinance is an honor system?
It's not that it's an honor system. It's that people know they have to comply with the code. And their license is at risk. Their livelihood is at risk. So they know they need to comply. Otherwise, they're going to face penalties.
Right, but that sounds like an honor system. Because if how are you guys going to prove that they didn't comply with it if you're not doing any tests?
Well, we would have to do some of these additional tests, but we would do that based on complaints that we have received.
But here's the catch-22. Say the homeowner calls the city to complain about leaky concrete block, like maybe it wasn't sealed. The city sends out an inspector and finds a code violation. Then guess who's on the hook for the violation? The homeowner. So there's not much incentive to report leaky construction to the city.
Yeah. This was one of those stories that made me really glad not to own property in Chicago. Because this woman that I interviewed was in that position. Michelle Elias had emailed the city and said, I'm having this problem. What can I do? And they were like, if we send out an inspector, the code violation is going to be yours. So she's like, oh, great. You know, it was just a huge can of worms. And there's so many problems in the real estate world in Chicago, and I only scratched the surface of it, really. But I mean, there was all these developers had formed as limited liability corporations, and then they dissolved as soon as they had built the building, so nobody could go after them after the fact. And a lot of them were bankrupt, or had, you know, they had lost money in the crash. And another story I did, it was a terrible, terrible construction. A lot of them were from Eastern Europe, and he had gone back to Poland. And these poor people were in the position where they had contacted the city, and the city had come out and had documented all the violations. And in this case, the city of Chicago had actually started suing the developers. They called them their bad developer lawsuits. But this case resulted in a huge conviction against the developer who was in Poland. And he was on the hook for like $750,000, but he was gone. And his company didn't exist anymore. And the scale of their problems in their building totaled like $150,000. And they had all these violations that the city had found that they were on the hook to, you know, fix. I mean, it's amazing, amazing problems that were going on there. So back to this story, number seven, I'd say, is make every attempt to reach the people in your story, especially the people who may be at fault. And that's just a general rule for any controversial story. You know, just leaving one phone message is not enough. Send them emails, try to reach their lawyer, and document that. In some cases, you know, find out where they live, take your recorder, knock on their door, and see if they'll talk to you. Even if they won't talk to you, at least, you know, you can record that. And have the tape of it and be like, look, these are the lengths that I went to get this person to, you know, respond to me. And for a couple of stories, I wound up trying to do that. And, you know, because these developers really had kind of skedaddled or, you know, slid under a rock somewhere. So, and then, you know, you never know. People might talk to you. One of the developers for that story I did on the bad developer lawsuits did talk to me. I mean, he didn't talk to me on tape, but I did get to, you know, put his side in there, which I think, you know, serves their you know, interests better than just having them in a story saying that they, you know, built this terrible building and then they couldn't be found. So number eight tip is streamline and keep boiling it down to what's most important and to what people are going to care about most. Kind of like what Gabe had been talking about. I mean, you're dealing with really complicated stuff. And it's easy. Was it you who asked the question about when you get in that world and you're always asking? Yeah. it's really easy once you are talking every day to these building inspectors about sealant and weep poles and flashing. I mean, I had explained that earlier in my story. You're probably like, what the hell is she talking about? Those are these things in the brick that let the water drain out. But it's easy to get lost in that world and to bring it back to everybody else who doesn't know anything about that. So always keep that in mind, especially as you're starting to write. The number 9 tip is to use something called signposts, which Gabe talked about a little bit. And this is something from Hannah Jaffe Wall on Transom that I would recommend all of you guys to go look at, transom.org. And she does her manifesto about how she approaches these really complicated planet money stories. And one of the big things, tricks that she uses is these things called signposts. They're kind of like mapping, giving a map to your listener to follow as they, you know, are listening to the story. And like with a story that's complicated and people's attentions are so divided and they're busy and everything, you need to keep giving them reminders of why they should care, you know, what this is about, why it's important, you know, those kind of things. Like, what are some examples? Just watch what happens next. That's one of her examples. Or here's where our story takes its last and craziest turn. Things like that keep you listening and keep you engaged. And also the whole idea of boiling it down, that whole David and Goliath. This is a story about, you know, one poor homeowner, Michelle Elias, taking on the city of Chicago or something like that. Now, I'm going to say another caveat is that I don't think I do this enough. It's something I want to do. But, you know, all of us have, you know, people that we look up to, like Hannah Jaffe Wall. And so it's something that I do want to incorporate in my stories, and I think that they would benefit from. So I'm not saying I have this in all my stories, but it's something that we should all aspire to. And then my last tip is fact check. When you've written your story, go back and underline each fact in it. Go back and find the original source, whether it's in your interviews, whether it's in the documents. Confirm, okay, was I really looking at the right line where that, you know, masonry inspector's job was eliminated? With, you know, make sure, were you looking at the right thing? These can be such complicated stories, and if it's something that's going to be dramatic, it's going to get a lot of people's attention, you want it to be right. I mean, this is serious stuff. I mean, you want all stories that you do to be right. But in these cases, especially if people's reputations are at risk, you just have to do everything you can to make sure that you got the story right. I have a really sad example of a mistake that still makes me cringe from my days at Bloomberg. When I was doing an investigative story where I had pulled up all of the stock sales of this one company by the board of directors and by the executives just to show how much these guys had cashed out. It was a software company called Siebel. And these guys had cashed out a lot of money. I mean, they had really, really done well. And none of them were talking to us. None of them, I was working on it with another reporter. None of them were doing interviews with us. But this one guy who was on the board, I had looked at all these forms, and we wrote in our story that he had sold like $114 million worth of stock, some crazy amount. And then, like 3 weeks later, it was weird that it came so late, but we got an email. He had been the CEO of Anderson Consulting. I don't know if you guys remember that company that went down in the whole Enron. Well, Arthur Anderson. No, he was the head of, I'm sorry, I think, Arthur Anderson or Anderson Consulting? Anyway, he was involved. He worked for that company. It turned out it was that company that owned the stock in Siebel. It wasn't him individually. These forms that I had pulled up had his name listed and an asterisk. And you had to follow the asterisk down to the bottom where it said, on behalf of Anderson. And I hadn't followed the asterisk. It was in a really tiny, tiny print. And so I had written that this guy, George Shaheen, had sold all this stock, when really it was the company. So that was big, you know, a huge black eye. We felt terrible. And, you know, it just was a very painful lesson about really, really checking your facts. Go ahead.
Tell them what they made you do at Bloomberg when you made an error.
You mean about the...
Didn't they parade you around?
No.
Did you have to, like, cop to it to everybody?
I forget what I was supposed to do. You mean to send an apology? I think I had to send an apology email to the bosses.
I thought they really put you through the ringer. No?
You blocked it out of your mind.
I don't know. I might have, yeah. It was really painful. I mean, and this was a story for their magazine, which was even more serious, you know, not just the wire service. Anyway, sad example, cautionary tale to all of you. To check your facts. So, in the spirit of open disclosure and things gone wrong, I'm going to lead on to my next story, which is another real estate story that took me a long time. So the concrete block story took me about, I'd say, 3 weeks to do. This next story I spent a few months on, and I did other stories in between. But this one is really complicated and thorny and involved an FBI investigation and involved me being threatened with a libel lawsuit and a lot of different scary things that kept me up at night. So let me tell you how this story started. A coworker of ours at WBZ had just bought a house. She was a first-time home buyer. And she did a story about it, about the whole experience of buying a house. And this was in 2011. So this house that she bought for $285,000, she walked us through what had happened. And, you know, in the kind of housing crash, things have gotten kind of weird. You know, like people are paying cash and, you know, getting houses kind of snapped out from under other people. So anyway, this house was a short sale. Her realtor said, this is a short sale. You guys might not know what a short sale is. It's with housing prices having fallen so much, a lot of people owe more on their mortgage than the house is worth. And that's called underwater. And a short sale means that they sell the home for that lower amount, and the bank kind of lets them off the hook for the amount of money that they still owe on their mortgage, and that's called a short sale. So this house had been listed as a short sale, and she and her husband, they really loved it, and it was, I think, listed for $240,000, and she put in an offer of $250,000. So then it was like radio silence. She didn't hear anything. So they were like, oh, dang, I guess we didn't get that house. A month later, they hear back from their realtor saying, hey, the house is for sale. An investor is buying it and wants to sell it, and are you guys still interested? And there's a lot of interest, and if you're really interested, you should put in your offer right now, and, you know, all this stuff about how they should hurry, and they were still interested. So they upped their offer. Let's see. I'm going to play this bit.
A lot of rushing, and so, yeah, we went with $285,000, and without knowing what was actually being offered by the investor, we just figured it must have been a high offer, so we'll do $285,000, rush, 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 and that's how it happened. Their offer was accepted, and they get to the closing table. And in passing, their lawyer tells them what the investor had paid for it. The investor paid $160,000, and I had to have him repeat it again that, yes, it was $160,000 that the investor bought it for, and we were shocked. So the investor paid $90,000 less than Susie's original offer. How could that happen? Our listeners said this sounded fishy, and lawyers I spoke with said it sounded fishy, so I started checking into it. Now Susie's here with me in studio to talk about what I found out. Hi, Susie.
Hey, Ashley.
First off, we just want to say we didn't continue this story to settle some kind of personal gripe on your part.
Right.
We just felt that this was newsworthy, and our listeners told us it was newsworthy, and this post-bubble world of property flipping was new to us, mm-hmm. So we wanted to figure it out and see how it works. Now, you made an interesting discovery about the investor who had bought your property and then resold it to you. What did you find out?
Right. So leading up to the closing of the property, we would get all sorts of documents that we needed to sign. And on those documents, the investor was also listed, and her name is Marcy Schmidt. And upon further research, we found that she actually works at Exit Strategy Realty, which is the company that listed the property. That is one of the things that jumped out at us right away as something that we couldn't really figure out and raised a lot of questions. I mean, one of the first questions is, it seems like they can get first crack at these properties by working together in the same office. And then it also raises the question, who is the realtor working for if the investor is their coworker? Is the realtor trying to get the highest price for the homeowner, or are they trying to get the lowest price for the investor? I mean, their interests may not line up there.
So so you can hear the way we approached that story. We tried to do something unusual, which is we started it out with a narrated kind of traditional storytelling, and then we went into this kind of two-way back and forth between me and Susie and wound up playing, you know, a few cuts of tape in that, but we thought it would be more conversational for this kind of complicated story. Yeah.
When they put their original offer in, was it a legal written-up offer?
Mm-hmm. They did, yeah. Well, yeah, I know. It's crazy.
Dual agencies,
they can sell. Right. Well, so, yeah, this is a super complicated story, and we were like, wow, how could this even happen? You know, why would... So Citibank held the original mortgage of the people who were doing the short sale. And that I could find just through property records on the house. And I called up Citibank, and Citibank's flack, and they said, okay, did you guys know that there was another offer for this house of $250,000? You know, why did you sell it for $160,000, you know, and not take the $250,000 offer? And they said, we didn't know about that $250,000 offer. Okay, that's weird. How come they didn't know about that offer? You know, so these things were kind of like, okay, this is very interesting, a very interesting situation. This is, you know, something that merits looking into more. And then the red flags of like, okay, so the investor works at the listing agency. How can that be? You know, so that's where we started from and got me going on this story. And I had already been doing some stuff on this whole concept of post-bubble mortgage fraud. You know, like, how are people making a buck in the wreckage of the housing crisis? And one thing that had popped up in my research was this concept of short sale flipping, short sale fraud. And it turned out that this is a widespread thing, that a lot of people have managed to, like, get these really low ball offers into the bank, and then on the side lined up another buyer to flip it to. And there was one data company that had estimated it to be like $300 million worth that banks were losing out on, because they didn't have all the information. They didn't know what that there was another buyer out there who wanted to buy it for more money. So I had already been in touch with the FBI for a separate interview about this kind of post-bubble mortgage fraud stuff, and I mentioned this house to them. They said, that's interesting. You know, give us the address, and let's talk to Susie. And so pretty soon the FBI was investigating this situation.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was reporting the story, and I started taking this example to different real estate lawyers and saying, how does this look? How could this happen? You know, and they said, well, you know, this could be an example of mortgage fraud. And so I was like, wow, that's pretty crazy. And so then I had this realtor friend that I had worked with on different stories, and named Gary. And I asked Gary, could you pull up a spreadsheet of all of the houses that have sold by Exit Strategy Realty in the past, you know, couple of years? So he did. And I started looking through all these properties and seeing how many of them had been flipped and how many had been flipped, you know, in very, you know, short amount of time. And it became clear that this woman, Marcy, who had bought Susie's house and resold it, hadn't really done much of this. But this other guy at Exit was like, had done a lot of them. His name is Mike Cuevas. And I started digging into him, and he had all this stuff online. He was one of these like classic kind of self-promoter dudes who had all these like YouTube videos out there about how you can make a killing in real estate and like all this stuff. And he would have workshops and webinars on, you know, how to make a lot of money in real estate. Just a really colorful guy, like 30 years old, you know, making a lot of money on this. And so I thought, oh, wow, that's pretty interesting too. So I compiled all the transactions that Cuevas had done. And then I I tried to get an interview with him. And at first, I kind of did the wrong thing of what I told you before about ambushing. I had just kind of gone to him just like, hey, I want to talk to you about short sales. And he blew me off and wouldn't do an interview. And so finally, I was like, listen, I want to talk to you about short sales you have done. I left this on his voicemail. And lawyers who say that it looks like mortgage fraud. So then he got back to me. Surprise, surprise. Yeah, meet me at my office with my lawyer, you know. So I did that. And I think I'm trying to remember the timeline. But I checked back in with the FBI at some point, and the FBI didn't know I was working on a story, and they were like, wait a minute, you're going to screw up our investigation if you do this. So that was scary. What do I do? You know, I'm the one who told them about it. I'm working on a story, you know? So I'm getting this, like, pressure from the FBI to not move forward or to hold my story until they come up with some kind of, like, criminal indictment against the guy, and we're like, oh my God, what should we do here? And so this is another tip, I'd say number 11, go to people you can talk to for advice. So my editor and I, we talked to a guy at Investigative Reporters and Editors named Doug Haddix. We talked to him for advice, and we spoke with Daniel Zwerdling at NPR, who's a longtime investigative reporter there. And they were just so helpful, even though neither of them had really run into this situation where you know, an FBI investigation is going on, FBI is telling you to hold the story. But they said, listen, you know, you've done this reporting. Just go ahead with your story. Just don't worry about the FBI, you know? Like, you can't be beholden to them, you know? So in the end, that's what we did. And I went ahead and interviewed Mike Cuevas, and that was not a happy conversation. But, you know, I got what I needed, and I got his response, and it actually was very useful in that he walked me through how he thinks he does this legally. And so, okay, great, you know. He didn't show me the documents that I wanted. Essentially, he uses something called an option contract with the original short sale homeowner. Like, when he's an investor... So I think what happens is a homeowner comes to Exit Strategy Realty and says, listen, we have this short sale we want to put on the market. We know you guys do a lot of short sales. So one of his agents will work with them, but he'll come in as the investor, and he'll say, listen, I can get this done for you quickly. I'll buy the property from you. I want you to sign this option contract that allows me to buy it from you. And what that option contract allowed him to do was he could put in his offer to the bank, saying, okay, I'll give you $160,000 for that house. The option contract at the same time allows him to act as if he's already bought the house. And so it was actually like Cuevas who would be listing the property for $240,000. So he said, you know, he was acting almost as if he had bought it, and that it was all disclosed and all this paperwork had been filed. You know, the bank knew about it, and he had disclosed he was an investor seeking to profit, and... this was all in the paperwork. Go ahead.
Was it hard to get him to do the interview?
Well, not after I told him that I wanted to talk to him about possible mortgage fraud.
But you know, a lot of people would say, especially with the lawyer there, I don't know, it seems like a lot of people would say no.
Well, I think the other thing is that he really believed, I think if he really were a crook, and this is where I think he was just skating on the edge of the law. I think he had figured out a way to play within the bounds of the rules by that much, you know, but he wanted us to know that he was, you know, everything was above board. He was doing everything legally. So he had an interest, and also he had this, like, online presence that he had to maintain. And so I think it was in his interest to talk.
And he went on record?
Yep. So I interviewed him.
Actually, did you get any legal advice about whether or not you could get in trouble with the FBI by them telling you, hey, knock it off?
I didn't get legal advice on that, but I told the FBI, listen, you know, I've talked with my editors and with other, you know, journalism experts, and they say, you know, that I should move forward. And at that point, they were like, okay, well, you've already, you know, reached out to Cuevas, so he knows you're working on it. So they thought, okay, the die is cast anyway, you know, like,
Okay, so before you did move forward, you did tell them what happened?
I told the FBI, yeah. And this is a case of, like, I don't know if I did everything right, you know? I really don't. But we felt like we needed to just move forward with the story. And in hindsight, because he was kind of skating along the edge, nothing's happened with the FBI. So I don't think they ever found anything. They passed it along to the justice, to the U.S. attorney to look up, you know, is this really legal? And I think probably what happened is the U.S. attorney was like, we looked into this and it's legal. So, yeah, I know. But anyway, so I did this interview with Cuevas. I start getting emails from him saying he's going to sue us for libel if, you know, we publish something inaccurate. And that's scary, too. So luckily, WBZ has an attorney on kind of retainer that we could talk to about this. And he explained, like, libel to us. I'm not an expert, but essentially it's something, reporting that exposes a person to hatred, shame, disgrace, contempt, or ridicule, injures a person's reputation, injures the person in his or her occupation. But the thing about libel is, if you report the truth, then you're okay. So as long as I reported what was in there in the county property records, that he had bought these houses at this much and then he had sold it for this much, that's the best defense for libel. And our lawyer said, you know, just do that. Make sure you do that. And then also that you have to, you know, run this all by him and make sure he knows of these allegations, which we did. And I think that he thought we were going to actually come out and say he committed mortgage fraud, which I didn't do, because he told me about all this, his way of doing it legally. And I went back to lawyers and I said, okay, he says he does it like this. Is that legal? And they said, okay, well, we haven't seen the option contract. He never showed it to me. But if he really did it this way, then okay, yes, it's legal. It's not great, you know? It's deceptive, but it's not illegal. And so what happened in the reporting of my story is that I found out that banks had gotten wise to this. Banks were losing out on this money, and so were Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the big, you know, government-sponsored mortgage institutions that buy up a lot of these mortgages, and they were losing out a lot of money on this. And Freddie Mac had put in a rule saying that these option contracts were not allowed anymore, and rules about, like, you can't flip it within, like, less than 30 or 60 days or something like that. So so that was also interesting information, because it showed that this was a big problem for them, and they, you know, they were taking action, and that they thought it was deceptive, even if it wasn't illegal. So I'm going to play the kind of the ending, where
if
it start.
I can mention something real quick. Yeah. Most of us work for organizations that can't afford a lawyer unless you have one on your board, or, you know, somebody kindly in the community. But is Rosie still here? Yeah. Tell me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the Alaska Press Club have a small fund that can be used to help, you know, small news organizations that have legal issues?
I think typically what we do is try to connect people, yes.
Okay. And sometimes it's just talking to another journalist who knows it real well. But
yeah.
So, you know, sorry.
Yeah, and don't forget about John McCain. You know, you might want to mention that these sort of informally on retainers for stations for free legal advice.
Yeah, I've found in my reporting I've relied on lawyers a lot for many things, and a lot of them are very helpful. And I think if you went to a First Amendment lawyer, you know, expert, and say, look, this is the situation I'm in, you know, explain libel law to me, blah, blah, blah. You know, would you even look at a script of mine beforehand? That they would probably do it for you. And that's what we wound up doing, is we showed the script to this lawyer and beforehand, and we played him the audio. And he, if anything, said we went too easy on Cuevas. He's like, this is outrageous, you know? So here's the ending part where I start with a quote from the fraud expert at Freddie Mac.
Freddie Mac considers it to be a deceptive business practice that deliberately omits crucial data to the short sale lender.
Cuevas, of course, says he doesn't think he's deceiving anyone. But in any case, the banks have now gotten wise, and now they're putting in place all kinds of rules that have basically shut this process down. Freddie Mac, a year ago, started requiring forms that everyone would sign, even realtors, if in a short sale, saying there's no hidden deal here, everything has been disclosed. And many banks now require that a property not be resold for 30 or even 90 days. So because of all that, Cuevas says he hasn't done any deals lately. The last one I could find on the Cook County Recorder of Deeds site was from March. Now, Susie, as an end buyer who bought a flipped home, I mean, how does all of this strike you? Conceivably, you could have gotten the home for $250,000, your original offer, instead of your end offer of $285,000.
Right. Well, you know, we are happy in our house, and, you know, no one twisted our arm to make the $285,000 offer. And, you know, I guess in the end, we still got a pretty good deal on it. But I guess what frustrates me is that, you know, during the bubble, people found ways to take advantage of the market. And, you know, with the market crash, people are still finding new ways to take advantage. I just feel like there aren't enough safeguards in place to protect people from this kind of thing.
What it also shows is how, since the market crashed, everyone's kind of making things up as they go along. I mean, banks are scrambling to figure out how to minimize their losses. Investors are looking for any possible way to make a buck in a, you know, pretty lousy housing market. And for now, this particular profitable niche has been shut down. A little too late for you.
Yeah.
But thanks for talking with me, Susie.
You're welcome, Ashley.
And for anyone interested in finding out more about this, we have a longer story up on our website, WBEZ.org. I'm Ashley Gross with Venture on WBEZ.
Okay, so I wanted to tell you what I think went wrong with this story. And it this wound up being like a 12-minute piece on the radio, this whole back and forth, with a couple of clips from Cuevas, you know, defending himself. And we went with this structure of this two-way because this is such a complicated story. Look, I've spent like 45 minutes talking about this story, you know, like how do you boil it down to something for the radio? And when I originally wrote up a script, my editor was like, this, oh my God, nobody's ever going to be able to follow this. So it was her idea to do it as this two-way, this back and forth with me and Susie. And I felt like it succeeded in that it was like kind of conversational. But where it fell down was it got really complicated. I talked really fast in the story. I think I didn't slow down and step back enough and do enough of those signposts of like, okay, why do we care? What is at stake here? What's most important? Stick with me. There's more, you know, crazy twists and turns to come, that kind of stuff. And so listening back, you know, I was really proud of this story when I did it because I put so much work into it. But then I was like, oh, dang, I don't think I really hit the mark with it. But I did a long, like, web version. And the story got a lot of feedback. There were 64 comments on our website from people about the story, both defenders of Cuevas saying, hey, he did nothing wrong. This is, you know, totally, you know, ruining his reputation unfairly, blah, blah, blah. And then other people who are like, this is out, you know, unbelievable. You know, I'm a realtor and I can't believe this guy was, you know, doing this. And so it started a big, you know, controversy. And I think it worked in that way. But I don't think that this passed the kind of play it for your mom test where you like play it for your mom. Do you really get it? Do you really, you know? So, you know, but you live and learn, right? So just, I know that now for the next one. And that is that. Do you guys have any questions about anything?
Is there any kind of rule of thumb of kind of your time budget versus how much content you have to produce of an investigative report like that?
You mean like how much time was I allowed to be on this story versus, well, I mean, and this is not the most relevant like example for daily journalists here in Alaska because I was given a lot of free time to do this because I also had a good situation in Chicago where I worked 3 days a week so I could stay home with our kids 2 days a week. And so because of that, they kind of just let me do special projects. And, you know, I did do some, you know, news spots and some features and interviews while I was doing this, but the requirements of me were not as huge as a station reporter here would face. So it's not necessarily the best example, but I think, you know, like I said, that spirit of inquiry, that trying to find things out, that can inform your daily reporting. Yeah. Anybody else? Go ahead.
What are some negative consequences from your story, like subjects that you've interviewed that have been hurt because of actions that have been taken after they get published?
Oh, you mean like where somebody's been indicted or something like that? Or?
Yeah, or people you don't think fairly were indicted, or have you ran into experiences like that?
You mean that something bad happened to the people that... Are you talking about, like, consequences?
Any of it, all of it.
I guess this FBI investigation would be, but that one didn't really go anywhere. So I can't really point to big, you know, results where, you know, a new law was passed or something where, you know, a lot of investigative reporting does result in that. And some of the stuff, I'm going to play some stuff from Howard Berkus of NPR, who has had a lot of concrete results come out of, you know, reporting, including a series he just recently did on deaths in grain bins. So maybe some of you guys heard that. But go ahead.
What?
Deaths in grain bins, like grain silos on farms. What was your question, Ellen?
Oh, I was just going to say, if you anticipated my question, you got so much feedback from the Cuevas story, and you're doing your job, and I didn't think you were talking too fast in a little bit, I heard. What kind of feedback did you get from the before or earlier story on the masonry in Chicago? Because that is our job, mm-hmm. to inform people, not just to do a grandiose story, mm-hmm. to make a reporter look like, hey, I'm really investigating.
Right.
But how much relevance did it have?
Yeah, that one also didn't, I wouldn't say, have any, like, concrete outcome where, you know, things changed at the city, but there was a lot. I mean, people cared about it. It got a lot of comments on the website. I got a ton of emails from people who were like, I'm in this situation, this happened to me. And I think, if anything, that one just kind of spurred me on to do more. Like, that led to that bad developers lawsuit story that I did. And just understanding how the scope of it. And I was proud with the bad developers lawsuit, too, because nobody was really reporting that this was an initiative of the city. And it was kind of the city acknowledging that there was all this bad construction out there, and, like, they wanted to do something about it. And it came about, I think, their effort, because people were complaining to Mayor Daley in Chicago, saying, you know, we just bought this condo, and it sucks. And so he's like, okay, get our lawyers on this, you know. But if only the city had really been on top of it when all these buildings were going up, maybe they could have avoided it,
and
you know?
Anchorage is the same. I mean, construction is notoriously corrupt.
Right.
It's usually after the fact that the abuses have come to light.
Right, and it's really sad.
Home ownership being one of the great icons of American life, I mean, it hits home. People either have a home and they're facing the shit, or they are hoping to get a home.
Right.
And have no idea what they're getting.
Yeah, and it's
a great thrust of interest for everybody.
Yeah, I think, like I said, finding stories that people care about, and I do think that kind of, you know, the real estate world, the home construction world is definitely something that people care about. I mean, I've never owned a home. I was kind of like, you know, how can I care about these people who are dealing with this shoddy construction, you know, boo-hoo, you know? But then it started to understand, you know, like, they really had saved up all their money for their down payment, put it in, and they bought these overpriced, you know, fancy, they looked really beautiful, these new condos, and then the water leaks in, and they have mold growing up their walls, you know, it's terrible. So, go ahead.
As you're following the trail of information, when do you get to the point where you're like, okay, I've got a ton of stuff here, it's going to have to become a series, or I'm going to have to go with one big story? And then if you do go with the series, how do you recap information so that you feel like you're giving a little bit of, you know, to the listeners, so you don't make them feel like they're an idiot, where you're like,
right,
recapping everything,
right,
over and over again.
Right.
So how do you sort of...
Yeah, I don't know if I have a good answer for that. I mean, we wrestled with that with this story, too, because it's like, okay, 12 minutes, are you kidding me? But we didn't feel like we could break it up into two pieces, and people who missed one, we're not going to follow what happened with the rest of the story. So that's why we went with that. Mm-hmm. But, like, this series that Howard Berkus did on the grain bin deaths, each one, he did a few different stories, each one tackling a different part of it, and he would kind of allude to stuff he had reported in earlier, and I think it did it in a really successful way. But anybody else? Go ahead.
Going back to your previous interview, do you think it helped you in the end to have him come in ready to defend himself, or do you think it skewed your understanding of the topic in general?
No, I think it helped. I think it helped because he was prepared. I didn't kind of come in there and then just, you know, hijack it, you know. And he, I mean, he was there with his lawyer. His lawyer, and I didn't feel like, I mean, it was a little bit tricky having the lawyer there because a couple times he interjected and stuff. And I'd be like, listen, this is an interview with Cuevas. But he knew that it was going to be tough questions, and he was prepared to say, okay, this is how I do all this legally. I was upset that he didn't show me the paperwork, and I wanted him to show me, break it down for me, show me one property, show me all the documents, show me, because he was like, you know, I'm doing this service by, you know, getting these short sales done really quickly, and I'm like settling all these liens, and I'm making it really easy for an end buyer like Susie. You know, who, because short sales notoriously take a long time, and one and there's so many problems with them. There's often like a couple of different mortgages with one bank and another one with another bank, and it can be really thorny. And so he was like, "Listen, I know how to navigate these. I can do them really fast, and I turn around and sell it to Susie, and I should be, you know, rewarded. That my premium should be that difference between the two prices." And you know, it was just really helpful to hear his perspective on it, and I wish he had given me more information, but you know, got what I got. So, anybody else?
Yeah. I was wondering about just kind of on a small town scale, when you have something you want to investigate, but some of the sources that you're going to have to need, you're going to have to talk to them about a lot of other stuff in the future because
yeah,
there's so many sources in a small town,
right?
And they're leaders of whatever groups that
right,
you're going to be reporting on how many times in the future,
right?
And then you kind of don't want to expose it right away because maybe it'll fall apart. It's not really
mm-hmm,
what you think it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if there's any tips on like,
I mean, are these people who
keep it like a secret and then all of, you know,
yeah,
you don't want,
right,
because it's a small town, so people talk, so
right,
if you start sniffing around, then
right,
maybe people will find out, and you don't
right,
want to burn bridges, which is like a panel thing that I've learned some things, but I still have some questions.
Yeah, yeah, it's really thorny. And are you talking about going to the people who might know of wrongdoing elsewhere? Is that it? Like the people who might have, like, not the people who might have done something wrong themselves, but people who might know about it? Is that what you're talking about? Like, you're trying to get people to confirm that this shady thing is going on? Or
that, I guess, yeah. I mean, I guess if you do enough homework, you'll hope, like, those people aren't related or working closely to maybe
mm-hmm,
the real need of what you're after.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
But, because, you know, it's a small town.
Right,
so
right.
So many people are working with
yeah,
you who are, like,
yeah. I don't know if I have really good advice on that, but I think that if you know that this is something really, I think you just have to evaluate, does it rise to the level, you know, of.
Yeah, and then what point.
Yeah.
Are you willing to say, like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
matter,
screw you guys. You guys are squandering.
Like, this is important enough.
Yeah.
Until that point,
you're squandering the city of Bethel's money. You know, you're doing this improper stuff. You know, that is worth it. And if you can just get one person to tell you that on the record, you know, who knows about it. I mean, that is really tricky. I don't know if I have good tips on that.
Is it worth it asking them to keep it quiet? Like, we're working on this story?
I think so. But I would, yeah, I would, before you went to those people and got it and let it leak out, marshal all of your documents and get as much of the paper trail first as you can. Like, you know, if you're looking into, you know, shady city accounting or something, get all of the different budgets, file FOIAs on different expenses that people have claimed, you know, that might be like luxury trips to Hawaii or something on the city's dime or something like that. File Freedom of Information Act requests and stuff like that. That's going to tip off the people there too, but at least you haven't gone and approached people who are going to be like, blah, 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 you know? And if you have a paper trail, you know, you can use that as the basis of something to report on. It's not just, you know, so-and-so told you. Go ahead.
So I guess on that note, I feel like a lot of cities here, or at least in my experience, have been pretty closed off when you do that. And they'll find some sort of excuse, typically personnel, Whenever you're filing a records request, for example, one of the city administrators in Unalaska had to resign unexpectedly. Got a great severance package, and the the rumor mill was saying the reason for that was because he was sending inappropriate messages using his city cell phone. They file a public records request for that, and they say it's a personnel issue. Because it's kind of sorted, you can't just run with this story. And you're kind of caught in a position.
You don't have anything to back it up.
You can't source a story. Like,
is there an ombudsman here in the state of Alaska for Freedom of Information Act stuff? No? There's no in Illinois they had created an ombudsman there where you could go to them and say, listen, I'm trying to get this.
Well, what ends up happening is, you appeal it to them and they take it to city council, and city council can vote on whether they think this is an issue. And then at that point you can take it to court. But is if you're a small station,
you don't have the money to take it to.
You don't have the money, and you don't have the time. Because you have other daily news responsibilities to take care of. So I mean, I guess, do you have any advice on kind of dealing with really, really completely shady and inappropriate responses to records requests?
I don't, but Gabe,
want to
go?
I was just thinking that if they're really taking the city council, then it becomes a story in and of itself. And you have to publicly shame them.
It's true.
Well, they delay as much as possible before it gets to that point.
Right. At some point, I was always very averse to doing this. Like, I'm partly because I'm a wimp and partly because I give people the benefit of the doubt and whatever, but at BEZ, a colleague of mine, we were trying to get access to the juvenile prisons. We had been promised this. And there's all this, by law, we should be able to do so, but they weren't giving us the right time. And at some point, we did a whole story that was nothing but shaming the hell out of all these officials. And I thought, oh, God, this is going to just make them totally close off to us and never talk to us again. But instead, they threw the doors open. So that, it can work. You got to be really careful about doing it. But at some point, you do a story saying, the city of Unalaska has, by vote and bureaucracy, is protecting this, records or whatever. Denying this. You have to be very factual about it, but that can, maybe wedge a crack open a little bit. And you got to be careful. You tell them that you're doing that, but you can't make it blackmail, right? You have to just be like, look, I just want to let you know that we're going to do a story, and it's either going to say...
And we'll go statewide.
It's either going to have the information that we want, or it's going to explain why we don't have it. And it's going to lay out this and attach things to it, etc.
Dan Ross says that all the time. That's some advice he gave me, because I always have a problem if people not calling me back. And so he was like, well, Emily, especially if they're public officials or public authorities or for the state or whatever, he just says, leave them a message, tell them when your deadline is, and that if you don't hear from them, you're going to say, this person did not return my phone call or whatever, or this person won't respond to my records request, and this is what KUC did. And usually people call you back right away.
But I think that's a good, that's a really good suggestion. That was a very concrete example of how, just saying, like, we've been trying to do this, kind of pulling back the curtain on the reporter's process. We've been trying to get into these juvenile prisons and they're not letting us. And then, okay, lo and behold, they're going to let you. And the Seattle Times just reported that yesterday about this. They had filed a FOIA for this report about how the police handled some May Day riots last year, and they were turned down. And they kind of went step by step. Look, we filed this. And then we were turned down, and it does exist, and they didn't give it to us until, 9 months later. And I think it can yield results down the road that they realize that that is not all going to be, fly under the radar.
Yeah, and sometimes we let them off the hook with the stock phrase, like, so-and-so couldn't be reached for comment, right? But the information didn't become available, which we do partially because we don't want to bore our listeners with a long thing every time, and partially because it's a little bit of a courtesy. But they kind of depend on that. When it can either be like, okay, so I called somebody at 4:30 on a Friday and they weren't there, that's one thing. But if you call them four times over the course of 2 weeks and send them an email and talk to their secretary and leave a message, then they're clearly evading you. And I think instead of just saying they could be reached for comment, you say, We called them on Tuesday, Thursday, Monday, and Wednesday, left a message with their assistant, and went to the office. And
sent five emails.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Spell it all out. Don't let them off the hook quite so easily. They have to own that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's good advice. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Do you have any advice for handling situations in which somebody is doing something that's not legal and you want to get in touch with them for a story that you'd like to do, but there's just incredible hesitancy about talking to you?
So is the story about them doing something that's illegal?
It's about the illegal thing that's being done, mm-hmm. and you know that they're doing it.
But you want them to talk about something else?
Or you want them to talk about the process or why they're doing it, something like that. So it's not necessarily targeting them.
Yeah. And is it something where you need them to go on the record, or could they talk to you off the record?
It would be something like drugs. And so it would be the topic where if you could get them, it would be really handy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because otherwise you don't really have anybody.
Well, I mean, I would say you contact them and be like, look, this is a story I want to tell. You know, how much are you willing to tell me? You know, are you willing to do it? First off, are you willing to do an on-the-record interview? You never know. Okay, maybe not. Okay, are you willing to do an interview with just your first name or something? And then you run it by the other editors who are going to be, airing the story. Are they okay with that? Okay, are you... before you go to that, I would say another option after you have... that I've used a lot, after they're kind of on the fence about whether they want to do an interview, is I have told people, okay, how about if I play you back the section that I've written and play your cuts to you over the phone before it airs? And I don't know if everybody thinks that that's okay, but I think it's okay, because if it's something really sensitive and they're going to be on the radio with this stuff, I think that's an okay compromise to make. And so I have done that for a number of stories. And every time they've been like, okay, that's fine, sounds good, So, but it gives them the reassurance that things aren't going to go out on the air that they have no control over, So I think that's a useful technique. And then maybe they'll just talk to you off the record or on background and give you other information, and then you can try to find other people who would go on the record.
How much would you be willing to change your story if they didn't like what they heard?
I mean, I think I wouldn't, I would be willing to take out a cut of tape, these weren't people like Cuevas. I wouldn't do that with Cuevas. Someone who I say, you have to speak for yourself in this, But these were situations where, I did some stories about a Boeing strike 13 years ago, and the company people were willing to talk to me, but they were really scared, and they were like, look, we're retired now. Our retirements are dependent on Boeing, if we piss them off, then... So in that case, I would be willing to say, okay, if you don't want this one cut of tape, there was one situation there where it was a little bit like he was about to tell me, don't use that cut of tape, and I had to make a case for it. I had a feeling that he might, he said something like, I felt like I'd just been named the captain of the Titanic before it hit the iceberg, and it was a great cut of tape. You want to use that, So I was like prepared. I knew he was not going to like it. But then he's like, oh, that's the one thing that I feel. And I was like, listen, it's really vivid. It's going to help people understand your situation. No one at Boeing is going to call you. And so they're taking away your retirement because you said, you felt like the captain of the Titanic. So he caved, But in that case, I think if he really insisted because he had been willing to do this interview and he was scared, I would have taken it out. So,
something maybe, if you don't mind if I add,
yeah.
Especially when you're covering sensitive topics, whether you're investigating or just, reporting that the mayor's son got arrested for DWI or DUI now, is to take a step back and remember you're not doing the story for the people in the story.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing the story for your audience and what best serves them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you certainly have to maintain your ability to contact somebody again who you might need to, and we'll talk about that in the Saturday afternoon session that Angela and I and Jacqueline Estes are doing on crossing the bridge without burning it down or something like that, mm-hmm. but on small community reporting. But it gets really easy to get sucked into particularly a compassionate source or somebody who sort of, you know, for whatever reason feels sorry for. And we're not big mean people. You know, we're not sitting here going, we want to hurt people. I don't think there's anybody I've run into, at least, you know, in Alaska, who does that. But we want to be fair, and we want to do our job, which is to serve the listeners. All that said, you also have to be sensitive to people's understanding of how the media work. Mm-hmm. I mean, I will treat a senator very differently than somebody who has never been interviewed before, who might live in a small community with bad bandwidth, who, like, you know, gets cable TV and that's about it, maybe one of our stations when the weather's going the right way. So, you know, you need to have that understanding, but still, who are we serving? We're not serving ourselves. We're not even serving our news director or our manager, even though they think we do. We're serving our audience mm-hmm. and our communities, and what's the best way to do that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people like Ed and Annie and Lori are great resources to talk to and get advice from, I think, on these kind of stories. I don't know if I should play this tape from Howard Berkus. I have Howard Berkus. Do you think I have time? It's like a 5-minute clip of it.
Yeah, that'd be the last thing. But yeah.
Or if people have a lot more questions, we could just do questions. Okay. Well, Howard Berkus, I think, is really an awesome reporter. And I don't know if you guys remember that mine explosion in West Virginia that happened a few years ago. He has been, like, the one person doggedly following that story. You won't see it in any papers ever. I mean, maybe in West Virginia, but not really nationally. And it's been incredible how he's done that. And I spoke with him about his techniques, both for getting people to talk to him and also for managing, like, data and hunting down documents and stuff like that. He had another series that aired recently about these people, who a lot of them are young boys who have died in grain silos, where they were kind of sent in to kind of knock the wet grain down, and then it just kind of sucked them in. And he did some really great reporting that showed, like, the companies were breaking the law the way that they were sending these kids in without proper, you know, protection, and that OSHA, which is supposed to be, you know, fining these companies that do bad things that endanger people, was not really doing its job. And they were fining, and then they were reducing their fines by dramatic amounts. And then there were no criminal indictments against the owners of these grain bins. So I'm going to just play you about a 5-minute section of an interview that I did with him. And first we started talking about his West Virginia mine stuff.
The first story that Frank Langford and I broke that first week that we were in West Virginia together was a story about the existence of a federal criminal investigation. And we broke that because Frank was knocked on, you know, somebody's door, and the guy answered the door and he said, I can't talk to you right now, the FBI's here. And we then spoke with other people who said, oh yeah, I talked to the FBI too. And then we confirmed independently that the FBI was conducting a criminal investigation. But if we hadn't been there and knocking on doors, and there were no other reporters doing that by that time, they'd all pretty much left, that's how we discovered that. Showing up is a major thing. One of the biggest stories I did was a story where I learned about an incident in which a manager at Massey Energy at the Upper Big Branch mine had ordered an electrician to disable a methane monitor, which is a safety device that is absolutely critical in coal mining. And this is a highly illegal thing and dangerous thing to do. And it took me several months to get one of the witnesses on the record. I had a number of them off the record, but I needed somebody on the record to say what happened that day. And one of the things that got that witness to finally talk to me on the record was that he had filed a whistleblower case against Massey Energy a separate issue. And I learned about that, and I showed up at his hearing. And he saw me there, and he knew I flew, you know, a couple thousand miles to get there, and agreed finally to talk to me after that hearing was over. I showed up.
I was just listening to a webinar on data reporting, and they talked about your use of databases for the grain silo stories and how you had to kind of figure out that there were other deaths that were not included in the initial data set that you had, that some of the deaths were being classified as poultry farm deaths or something like that. Like, how did you figure that out? And then how do you have confidence in the data that you have at the end that it's solid?
That is one question you have to keep asking yourself as you're going along. Is this data reliable? And we found in the grain bin data that we were looking at, early on as I was pulling down cases and going through the database, I noticed that there were three cases in particular that we were sort of tracking, that we were looking at very closely. They happened to be among the three worst cases ever in the history of grain bin deaths, and none of them were in the database that we were looking at, which seemed really odd to us. You know, these were the three worst cases. They had among the three highest fines ever levied. Why were they missing from this database? We realized, number one, that cases were miscoded. And so what we realized is that you couldn't rely on this database alone to pick up these cases. And so I searched the online OSHA information and found that there are weekly fatality reports. And I had to go through hundreds and hundreds of these cases to find those that related to grain bins. And that was the way I was able to build a much larger database than what was available from where we thought we would find these cases in the OSHA data.
Wow. I guess with a story like that, there's such inherent drama that it wasn't that hard to make it so scene rich and sound rich.
Oh, actually, one of the most difficult aspects of this story was getting the survivor to talk to us. That took 5 months. You know, we were ready to give up at a couple of points because he's had a very, very difficult time since this incident happened. But he's an NPR fan, and every time I went back to Illinois, I'd let him know, and I'd say, I'm going to be here. You know, if you're up to it, I'd really like to talk to you. And he asked me a number of times, he says, why is it so important for me to be interviewed by you for this story? And I told him that he's the one person who was there who could really explain how horrific this situation was. He finally agreed to talk. The timing just worked out good. The other thing is that he was keen on, you know, the biggest thing to him was getting a gravestone for his friend Alex, who had died in that grain bin.
Mm-hmm.
There's no headstone at Alex's grave. And I said, I can't be in the business of raising money for you. We're not going to do that. But I said, let's go to the cemetery and let's talk about what happened and your friend and the fact there's no gravestone there, which we did. And the radio story wasn't even off the air before somebody came forward and offered to pay for a gravestone. And we've had 4 dozen people offer to contribute to one.
Yeah. And he also said that OSHA has now, you know, said we can't reduce fines anymore, you know, in the wake of his stories, that he's seeing some concrete results from that. And I just thought that was so interesting, hearing like the back and forth that he had with that source trying to get him to talk, and like let me tell you the benefits. Maybe you'll get a gravestone for your friend. Like, I mean, that's like getting into a weird territory there, I think, as a reporter. But it's interesting, you know, what went into it. And so I guess we don't have any time for more questions. I don't know.
A quick question or two, and then it's lunchtime. And, I mean, people can continue to discuss.
Yeah.
But
is anybody else?
I missed your tip number two.
Oh, my tip number two was just start talking and reading to lots of people to get a handle on the scope of the issue. It's not a very exciting tip.
Essential.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, Lori? I just wanted to add to that point that, you know, it is ticklish areas to get into
saying, well, you might benefit from this talk.
Right.
And I felt that he handled it really well.
Yeah.
I can't help you raise money.
Right.
Right,
and it's a really dramatic scene. I was going to play that segment from his story, but since I don't have time, I would recommend you guys go back and listen to his grain bin stories, and it's really emotional, you know? He's, like, bringing some flowers. It's just, like, a little plastic thing there for his friend, you know? It's really amazing.
I have a question about just, like, he was talking about knocking on doors, and Gabe did mention this, too. When you guys actually go to, like, knock on someone's door, are you rolling tape? And if you are, how do you let people know? Because I've walked up to people with tape rolling before, and it really freaks them out. But sometimes you get, like, that action.
Yeah, you really want that. I mean, you want the sound of the door, you knocking on the door and them greeting you or whatever. What I do in those cases, and, you know, I just say, just do it. I have it recording. I've knocked. They've answered. And then I'd be like, I have, you know, my mic recording, you know, now. Just let them know that that's happening. And in terms of, like, really difficult situations, like, I've only done that, I think, once, you know, and they were basically like, no, we can't talk, he's not here, you know, okay, whatever, that's it.
But if it's somebody you really want to get, that's probably not the best strategy, because...
Right, right. You know, if it's going to be, if you know that it's going to be a hard interview, and you're hoping, you do have hope that they're going to talk to you, I wouldn't do that. But it's kind of a last-ditch effort, for me it was, in this case, of... just getting on tape, showing the lengths that I had gone to get this person to talk to me. But yeah, it can be kind of intimidating.
Okay, well, let's break for lunch, but thank you very much, Ashley.
Okay.
Ashley will also be part of a covering labor panel tomorrow afternoon.